Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Cabinet of Curiosities on Our Own Devices. I'm Jean Mercier, and today we're continuing our look into the history of amateur photography. But this time, we're not going to be looking at cameras, but rather that most indispensable of photographic accessories, the camera flash. And courtesy of my good friend Doug Carpenter, I have here a wide variety of historic camera flash systems, which should give us a unique opportunity to look at the history of this technology from the mid-19th century until the present day. So let's dive right in. So as we've discussed on this channel before, in the early days of photography, cameras were very primitive and limited in capability. They used glass plates with wet emulsions that were extremely slow, meaning that exposure times were long, on the order of several minutes. And indeed, these early cameras didn't even have shutters in most cases. The photographer simply took a picture by removing and replacing the lens cap. Now, this is all well and good for still life photography, but when you're taking portraits or really taking pictures of anything that moves, you run into the problem of motion blur with these extremely long exposures. And so portrait photographers often had these metal frames with neck clamps to try and keep their subjects perfectly still. Now, the obvious solution to this problem is to flood the subject with a very intense light in order to reduce the exposure time. And in the very early days of photography, certain photographers made use of limelights, which are a type of gas light where the flame is directed onto a piece of calcium hydroxide, or lime, producing a very intense white light. And the use of this technology in a theater context is what gives us the modern expression to be in the limelight. But limelights were big and bulky and inconvenient to use, and really a far more compact technology was needed that could produce the same burst of extremely bright light. Now, the very first flash photograph that we know of was taken in 1851 by William Henry Fox Talbot, who was a major innovator in early photography. And the experiment that he conducted was pretty neat. For his flash, he used an electric spark, which he generated by discharging a large bank of capacitors across a pair of electrodes. And he took the front page of a newspaper, mounted it on a rapidly rotating disc, and using the spark, which only lasted 1/100,000th of a second, was able to take a perfectly clear photograph of the spinning newspaper as though it had been standing still. Now, despite this, this turned out really to be more of a scientific curiosity, and practical flashes for photographers would have to wait another decade. And in 1859, the great chemist Robert Bunsen, of Bunsen burner fame, discovered that if you burn the element magnesium, it produces a very intense white light with spectral properties very similar to daylight. But this discovery would have to wait a couple of years before it could be practically applied, because at the time, magnesium was very rare and expensive to produce. And it would not be until 1862 that a gentleman named Edward Sonstadt came up with a practical economic means of mass producing magnesium and set up the Manchester Magnesium Works in order to produce magnesium wire and ribbon. And the first practical camera flashes were based on this technology. So the first flashes, you've probably seen these in old films or period pieces, was a metal tray with a wooden handle, and you would put a length of magnesium wire or ribbon in the tray, the length of the ribbon dictating the intensity and the duration of the flash. And indeed, the containers that this ribbon came in, and quite often the flash trays themselves, were graduated so that you could actually measure out exactly the length of wire that you needed. And this wire would be ignited by a variety of means. In the early days, typically a match or a candle or some other sort of open flame, but then later mechanical and electric mechanisms. And then in 1887, a pair of German inventors named Adolf Meiter and Johann Gedicke came up with what they called Blitzlicht powder, or lightning light, what we now know as flash powder. And this was a mixture of magnesium powder, potassium chlorate, antimony sulfide, and sulfur. And like gunpowder, it was very easy to ignite with a spark, and when it went off, just like burning magnesium ribbon, it produced a very intense flash of white light. And this would be used very similarly to the magnesium ribbon. It would just be sprinkled into the top of the flash tray. And in the early days, again, it was set off using some sort of open flame, a match or a candle. But later you ended up with mechanical mechanisms for producing sparks, which were very similar to the wheel lock mechanism from early firearms, where you had a clockwork spring that would spin a rough metal wheel against a flint to produce sparks. And then in 1899, Joshua Lionel Cohen of Lionel Trains fame patented an electric ignition mechanism using batteries. Now, while this was a great leap forward, flash powder did have certain disadvantages, namely safety. It burned at an extremely high temperature and could inflict gruesome burns, and there are tons of horror stories from this era of photographers being badly burned in accidents involving flash powder. The classic one being, you know, you try to set off your flash, it doesn't go off, you go to look inside, and the powder gets disturbed, and then it finally ignites and blows up in your face. And there were a number of other disadvantages as well that were not related to safety, one being consistency. It was very difficult to get the exact same brightness and duration of flash from load to load because you were just randomly sprinkling powder into the tray. And also, when flash powder went off, it produced a very thick white smoke, mainly composed of magnesium oxide. And in a studio setting, this would quickly fill the air and reduce the quality of each subsequent photograph. But in a larger setting, it would rise up to the ceiling, cool down, and then sink and coat every surface in this very pernicious white powder. So professional photographers who were attending, say, banquets or weddings or things like that, very quickly learned to leave before the dust literally settled and leave that to be somebody else's problem. Yet despite these numerous disadvantages, flash powder proved a remarkably long-lived technology and was actually still being used, at least in a professional studio setting, well into the 1950s, for reasons we'll look at a little bit later. But by the turn of the 20th century, inventors were really starting to look into means of granting photographers a more convenient, more compact, and safer means of taking flash photographs, especially the growing numbers of amateur snapshot photographers made possible by the introduction of Kodak Brownie cameras. Enter the flashbulb. So the principle of the flashbulb is really very simple. Rather than having your combustible flash material in an open tray as in the traditional system, you instead enclose it within a glass bulb, which both contains the smoke produced and protects the photographer from getting burned. Now, the very first, what we might call flash bulb, was invented in 1893 by French inventor Louis Boutin, who was one of the first to take photographs underwater in the open ocean. And in order to produce the large amounts of light that you need for taking photographs underwater, he used a large magnesium ribbon contained in a glass globe filled with oxygen. And this would be ignited using a battery contained in a large wooden box filled with lead weight so that it would actually sink. However, it wouldn't be until the 1920s and the perfection of the industrial process for mass-producing ordinary electric light bulbs that the first commercial-grade flash bulbs would appear on the market, the first being patented in 1925 by Paul Fierkater. However, the first commercially successful flash bulb, the Vacublitz, would be patented in 1929 by Johann Ostermayer and produced by the German firm Hauser. This would be followed the next year by General Electric's highly successful Sascha light, and in 1935 by Philips's Photoflux bulb. So these early flash bulbs were built identically to light bulbs with a threaded metal base and a glass bulb, but rather than having a carbon or a tungsten filament inside, they were instead filled with metal foil, which was ignited by passing a current through the base of the bulb. Now this foil, and later wool, was originally made out of magnesium, but this was later supplemented with and then replaced by zirconium, which burns with a brighter white light, and then aluminum, which is a lot cheaper. Now, magnesium burns readily in atmospheric air, but zirconium and aluminum do not. So these bulbs had to be filled with pure oxygen in order for the metals to burn effectively. This, however, created a problem since the burning of these metals created a lot of exhaust gases, which could overpressurize and shatter the bulbs. So these bulbs had to be filled with oxygen at lower than atmospheric pressure so that the excess pressure created by the exhaust gases would not exceed the structural limits of the bulb. This, however, created more problems, namely if the bulb leaked and the pressure equalized, then the bulb could burst. and this was dealt with in a number of ways. One was to put some sort of warning that the bulb had leaked. The firm Sylvania became famous for its blue dot, which was a chemical indicator applied to the inside of the bulb that was normally blue, but if the bulb leaked and admitted regular atmospheric air, the dot would change to pink and it would tell you that the bulb was no good and would probably explode if you tried to use it. But eventually this turned into just sort of a standalone trademark. People, you know, learned to trust the Sylvania blue dot without having any idea what it was even for. The other solution was to coat the bulb in either shellac or thin plastic so that if it did shatter, like with safety glass, the plastic or the shellac would contain the fragments. And this had the further advantage that you could color this shellac or plastic, which is indeed what they did on many later bulbs. And this was done for use with color film. So a plain white flash bulb worked well enough for black and white film, but for color balanced color film, you needed to add a blue filter in order to more closely mimic the daylight that the film was formulated to be used in. And in early flash guns, you also get, as in this one, a little plastic or glass shield that fits over the flash reflector in order to further contain any fragments should the bulb explode. So flash bulbs came in a wide variety of shapes and sizes, and one of the most popular was the Press 40 bulb, which if you've ever seen a period piece where the newspaper reporters are running around with their big press format cameras with the big flash gun and reflector, is the type of bulb that they would have used. And the sizes ranged all the way up to true monsters like the Mazda 75. And to give you an idea of how powerful this bulb was, this was intended for aerial photography at night. So this bulb could illuminate the ground clearly enough to take a photograph from an altitude of 30,000 feet at night. But despite the fact that these bulbs were a godsend to newspaper reporters who could now take photographs at indoor events without coating the furniture in pernicious white dust, they really didn't become common among amateur snapshot photographers until the 1940s or 1950s. And this is because early flash bulbs were very expensive to manufacture. They used the same process as ordinary light bulbs, and the process of attaching the bulb to the metal base, etc., was extremely time-consuming and expensive. And so the use of flash powder persisted for a long time, not only among professional photographers, but also amateur photographers. And something interesting that I came across in researching this video was an amateur flash powder tray apparatus that was sold alongside the Kodak Brownie box. And this consisted of a little tin can that you would open and you would pull out the tray and fix it to the top so that the tin can formed the handle. And also inside the can was a double compartment tube filled with flash powder. So you would mix up the powder, put it in the tray, and then there would be a special groove where you would fix a match or a wooden splint. And to take your photograph, you would trip the shutter at the same time as you tipped the tray forward and sent the powder into the flame, thus igniting it. And in the late 1940s, early 1950s, you saw the development of the baseless flash bulb, where rather than having a metal base like a light bulb, it was just a glass envelope with the wires coming directly out of the glass. And these were a lot cheaper and were a lot more available to the average public. And this is how flash bulbs really entered the mainstream for snapshot photography. And we'll have a look at that a little bit later. So early flash bulbs were designed to be used with a separate manually operated flash gun. And the standard procedure for taking a flash photograph in the early days was the so-called open flash method. And to do this, you would open up your shutter, then manually set off your flash gun, and then close your shutter. Now this took a considerable amount of coordination to get right, and it really wasn't ideal when you were trying to take pictures of something that was moving very quickly where you needed a short shutter speed. But in 1932, a press photographer named Samuel Mendelssohn came up with a jury-rigged contraption consisting of batteries, switches, and a solenoid that would set off his flash gun automatically whenever he tripped the shutter on his camera. And Mendelssohn would go on to patent and market a successful line of flashes known as speed guns. However, these very earliest synchronized flashes really didn't work all that well. And the reason has to do with the fact that the time to ignition and the time to maximum brightness once you've ignited your flash bulb was considerably longer than the shutter speed, which meant that even if you set off your shutter and your flash gun at the same time, the shutter most likely would have opened and closed by the time your bulb had even ignited or reached peak brightness, and that really doesn't do you any good. And so an important feature on some of these earlier flash guns was a synchronization feature, which provided a delay to make sure that the bulb had ignited and had reached peak brightness by the time that the shutter had opened. And so this typically used either flywheels or a train of gears that could be continuously adjusted so that you could dial it in and get the flash perfectly synchronized with your shutter. Still, the system wasn't perfect, namely because there was a great deal of inconsistency in the performance of early flash bulbs. The time to maximum brightness could vary quite a bit from bulb to bulb, so while you might have had your flash gun synchronized to the very first bulb you used, it might not be synchronized to the very next. But again, with time, this problem was eventually solved, and manufacturers started producing flash bulbs with standard delays, classified as F, M, S, and FP. So the F, or fast bulbs, had a time to maximum brightness of no more than 12 milliseconds, the M, or medium bulbs, 20 milliseconds, the S, or slow bulbs, 30 milliseconds, and the FP, or focal plane bulbs, 40 milliseconds. Now the FP bulbs were intended for cameras with a focal plane shutter, which is basically a slit that travels from one end of the film strip to the other. And the idea is that you want a very long flash to fill in that entire time. Otherwise, one side of the photograph is going to be considerably brighter than the next. Now, originally, these flash guns were not directly integrated into the camera. They were attached via a bracket, but they had to be attached to the synchronizing mechanism using a cable. And the standard that emerged was invented by a company called Prontor Compure. And this is a 3.5 millimeter socket cable. And this is still used to this day on certain professional flash guns and has become known as the PC cable. And then later you had the development of the peg and screw mechanism, such as on this Kodak Hawkeye, where, as you can see, you have two terminals attached to the camera. One is just a pin that fits into a socket, and then the other is threaded with a knob that allows you to secure it nicely to the side of the camera. And then in 1938, cameras came out incorporating the very first hot shoe. So cameras for many years had incorporated a little sheet metal shoe for accessories such as a light meter or a rangefinder, like we saw in one of my earlier videos. But in these cameras in 1938, these finally incorporated a set of electrical contacts wired to the flash synchronization mechanism in the camera that finally allowed a convenient mounting place for a wide variety of accessories, including flashes. Now, flash guns, like flash bulbs, came in a wide variety of designs, shapes, and sizes. And the one attached to this Kodak Hawkeye here is a fairly standard example, but there were more interesting varieties. For example, this one attached to this ViewMaster camera. And yes, this is a stereo camera used to create the slides for the little ViewMaster devices, if anybody remembers those. And this is particularly interesting, not only because it has this flip-up plastic shield to prevent a bursting flash bulb from escaping, but also because it integrates a rangefinder on the side here to allow you to set the focus on your lenses. And I just think that's neat because it just shows that even in the past, they were trying to integrate as much functionality into a single accessory as possible. But for my money, the most fascinating flash guns are the subcompact ones. So for example here, you have this little Tully flash gun set up for a sub-miniature baseless bulb, and the reflector on this is like a little flower with petals that can telescope in and out by moving the sliders backwards and forwards. It also has a convenient little ejection mechanism right here where when the bulb is spent, you just pop the button on the back here and it spits the bulb right out. Or this Ryko flash gun here, which folds up kind of like a satellite dish so that you can actually fit this into a nice little convenient pouch and carry it around. And this one, as you can see, actually has an adapter. It's meant to take a much larger flash bulb, but this adapter allows it to take a smaller model. But while by the 1960s, flashbulb technology had really reached its zenith with the development of affordable, subcompact, baseless bulbs and the refinement of flash synchronization and standard bulb delay times, the whole technology, the whole system still had one major flaw, which was that each bulb could only be used once. Once you'd taken one flash photograph, if you then wanted to take another, you had to remove the old bulb and insert a new one, which was very inconvenient if you were trying to take multiple flash photographs in quick succession. And so starting in the 1960s, manufacturers started coming up with various systems to give photographers the ability to take multiple flash photographs in quick succession. And one of the first successful systems was introduced by Sylvania in 1965 and was known as the Flash Cube. And the flash cube consisted of a little plastic cube with four miniature bulbs, one on each face, with a built-in Mylar reflector. And this fitted into a special socket in the top of a camera. And once you'd taken a photograph with your flash and you advanced the film, it would automatically rotate the flash cube 90 degrees, giving you a fresh bulb. And so you could take a maximum of four flash photographs in a row before having to replace the flash cube. And these were extraordinarily successful and popular. But there soon came a problem when companies started coming up with extremely cheap and simple cameras, especially those that took cartridge film. The original flash cube was electrically actuated, and so the camera needed to have a battery inside to set off the bulbs. However, these typically children's cameras like this one didn't have any sort of battery. There wasn't room for one. And so how do you set off your flash bulb? Well, the solution was something called the Magic Cube or the X Cube, where the ignition for the bulb was actually mechanical. So inside the cube is a series of little torsion springs that are usually set up against a peg to stop them from swinging forward. And when the camera was activated, when the shutter was set off, a little pin would protrude up and lift that little spring and allow it to swing over. It would then strike a piece of fulminate, basically like the primer on a cartridge for a firearm, and that would then ignite and set off the flash bulb. And I actually have one here, and you can actually set these off manually with something like a toothpick or a skewer. So I'm just going to show you how that works right now. I'm going to push this up against the bulb and flash, just like that. So magic cubes are also known as X cubes due to the shape of the socket that fit into the camera. And this was deliberately made to be different from that on the electrically actuated regular flash cubes so that the two would not be confused and interchanged, because one being mechanically actuated and the other being electrically actuated, they were not compatible with each other. Now, while flash cubes remained popular for many decades, they were not the only multiple flash technology on the market. In 1975, Sylvania came out with what it called the flash bar or the flip flash, just like this one. And as you can see, it's one big unit with five flash bulbs on one side and another five on the other. And this would fit into a symmetrical socket on the top of the camera. And so you would insert it, you would be able to take five flash photographs in a row, and you would pull it out, flip it around, hence flip flash, and then use the other five. This is a flash bar, which is a horizontal format, but there was also a vertical flip flash, which had the advantage that the farther away the flash bulb is from the lens, the less red eye effect you get. And I find the flip flash particularly fascinating because of the way that it goes about sequencing the bulbs, how it makes sure that each bulb fires one after another. And it does so by taking advantage of what is normally a disadvantage or a waste product of using a flash bulb, which is the heat of combustion. So every time a flash bulb goes off, the heat causes some shrink tubing to shrink, and this connects up the circuit to the next bulb and also disconnects the bulb that's just fired. And that's because if there's any leftover metal inside the bulb, it might cause a short circuit and stop the next bulb from going off. And this is how it sequences. Every time a bulb goes off, the shrink tubing shrinks and connects up the next bulb, disconnects the previous bulb, and on it goes through all 10 flashes. So just a really elegant analog way of going about this problem. And apparently it was a very reliable one because these stayed on the market for many, many years. Yet despite this burst of innovation, by the late 1970s, early 1980s, flash bulbs were really on their way out as the first truly affordable electronic flashes started to hit the market. Now, electronic flashes had actually been around for a couple of decades before this. The very first camera to have a built-in electronic flash was actually the Voigtlander Vitrona, introduced way back in 1964. But these early flashes were very bulky and heavy. You typically had to have a separate battery pack in a satchel at your side to make them work. And they were too expensive for anybody but a professional photographer to afford. And interestingly enough, the technology is even older than that, having been developed in the 1930s by Harold Dock Edgerton of MIT. And he developed the xenon strobe, which is a gas discharge tube full of xenon. And when you discharge a current from a capacitor through it, it produces a very brief and bright flash. And using a xenon strobe, Edgerton was able to take some of the very first and most famous high-speed photographs, including the famous one of the bullet going through an apple, or the milk drop turning into a perfect coronet, or some of the early shots of atomic bombs going off during tests. So from the 1960s onwards, this technology became progressively more compact, lighter, and less expensive, so that by the late 1980s, early 1990s, nobody was really using flash bulbs anymore, and most cameras came with an electronic flash as standard. And it was really a far superior system, as you could use it over and over again an almost infinite number of times, unlike any flashbulb-based system. And we still see a lot of xenon flashes around today, though they're gradually being replaced by even newer LED technology, which is even faster, more controllable, and less energy intensive than the xenon system. So there you have it, the nearly complete 150-year history of the camera flash, an often unsung but absolutely vital photographic accessory. Anyway, that's all I have for you today. Once again, a huge shout out to Doug Carpenter for allowing me to look through his camera collection and pull out these items to show you today. Thank you so much for watching, and I will see you next time on another episode of Cabinet of Curiosities, where we'll look at yet more fascinating artifacts just like these. Until then, I'm Jean Messier from Our Own Devices. Have a great day.